This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest.
Coming up in today's program, a special look at an age-old institution across Europe, monarchies. The British monarchy remains secure, but the subject of the family's wealth has become an issue. In Bulgaria, King Simeon II governed the country from 2001 to 2005, not because he is the king, but because he won the general elections. Poland hasn't had a king since 1795, but some would like to change that. In Germany, there are no kings or queens to talk about, but interest is high, so Germans simply look beyond their own borders to those countries which still have active royal households. And in Sweden, the monarchy is alive and well. We'll visit an exhibition honoring one of the most popular members of the royal family, Queen Silvia. At the helm today, I'm Juan Navas. One of the oldest monarchies in Europe is the House of Windsor. Britain's royal family can trace its roots back to William the Conqueror in the 11th century. As an institution, the British monarchy remains secure. There is little appetite for a republic. But in recent years, the popularity of the Queen and her close relatives has declined, largely because of the antics of some of the younger members of the family. And as Stephen Beard reports from London, the subject of the family's wealth has become an issue.
On the occasion of her 80th birthday earlier this year, the British Queen received the customary tribute from the House of Commons.
Parliament salutes its sovereign. We offer you our respect, our affection, and our prayers.
But while the Queen can always expect such grovelling from public officials, there's noticeably less adulation these days among her ordinary subjects. Even among those Brits that support the monarchy, and most do, there's unease about Elizabeth's remoteness and her money.
She doesn't know how the ordinary people live. She doesn't know how people have to manage their finances. Some people would be very jealous of the lifestyle she has.
Because she doesn't know what the value of money is, I don't think. You know, coin-wise, I mean, she doesn't carry money around and have to live on a budget like the ordinary people.
The size of the Queen's personal fortune can only be guessed at. Some estimates put it at more than $10 billion. It's not entirely clear whether all of the seven palaces she uses, all the paintings and the furniture, are hers, or whether they belong in part to the state. But far more controversial is the $70 million she cost the British taxpayer last year.
Keep the monarchy, but maybe in a lower key. Less financial involvement from the public.
Oh, you don't like paying for it? Is that the problem?
They've got enough money of their own. We shouldn't have to finance them. They're a very, very wealthy family.
The monarch's money is clearly a sore point. During the 1990s, she was forced, as a result of public uproar, to start paying income tax and to foot the bill herself when a fire damaged Windsor Castle. The subject of money seems to jar with the pomp and ceremony that surrounds Her Majesty. It seems undignified to talk about filthy lucre and the Queen in the same breath. But don't kid yourself, says Professor Stephen Hazler. For members of the royal family, money is always at the forefront of their minds.
The one thing about the British royal family is they've always been extremely astute as far as money is concerned. This is contrary, of course, to the myth that's put out, that this is all for public service, history, and all that kind of stuff. This is a very, very sharp cookie family indeed.
The House of Windsor has taken quite a financial beating in recent years. Last year, the heir to the throne, Prince Charles, had to pay $6 million in income tax. And then there was his ill-fated first marriage to Princess Diana.
Richer for poorer.
For richer for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
To love and to cherish.
That marriage left Charles poorer. After their divorce, she got $30 million out of him. But put that in perspective, says Kevin Cahill, author of Who Owns Britain. Charles draws an income from a huge estate, the Duchy of Cornwall.
It's about 141,000 acres. A very big estate for England. And It's in the books at about, say, $600 million, but its real value is at least double that.
All this talk of the royal family's inherited wealth has underlined the economic case against the monarchy, says Professor Haisler.
If you do revere inheriting estates and revere inheriting fortunes as opposed to making money, and it's not a good message for a country that wants to be economically dynamic.
In fact, only a small minority of British people would like to see the monarchy replaced by a republic. But all the scandal of recent years and the revelations about the cost of the royal family have devalued the monarchy's most precious asset, public respect and affection. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
You're listening to Network Europe. In Europe, kings and queens take part in numerous official ceremonies throughout the year. They make state visits abroad, but they rarely rule. Each year in Britain, the queen reads a speech in Parliament, but she speaks on behalf of her government, reading a speech written by the prime minister. In Monaco, the prince actually rules the principality, but Monaco is an exception. Bulgaria is an interesting case because King Simeon II governed the country from 2001 to 2005. Not because he is the king, but because he won the general elections. But is Simeon II a monarch or a politician? Radio France International's Nick Champeau went to Sofia to find out.
Before going to Bulgaria, I read an article by British journalists who were actually invited for dinner at the king's palace in the outskirts of Sofia. So I packed a jacket and tie, hoping that I too would meet His Majesty and get a taste of royal treatment. Unfortunately, on arrival, his assistant confirmed to me that His Majesty was out of the country. So instead, I went to the National History Museum and met museum guide Agnes Aprubokiova.
This is a special award given to Mr. Simeon Saxe-Coburgota as the Prime Minister of Bulgaria. He was awarded with a great order by the King of Spain, Juan Carlos, on the 29th of September 2004.
Is he still officially the King of Bulgarians?
No.
It seemed like a straightforward question to me. Bulgaria is a republic, but Agnesa refused to answer. Prince Simeon II was born in 1937. He became King Simeon II when his father died in 1943, but he had to flee the country together with his sister, mother, and aunt 3 years later to escape communism. He lived in exile for almost 50 years, mainly in Spain. The tall, slim, bearded businessman returned to his country after the fall of communism, first as a visitor, then as a politician, a successful one. His moderate right-wing party, the Simeon II National Movement, won the 2001 parliamentary elections. That doesn't mean Bulgarians suddenly became nostalgic about the monarchy. Historian and deputy museum director Svetlana Kioseva says Simeon II just happened to be the right man at the right time.
The role played by Simeon in Bulgarian history will be best analyzed by historians in 20 or 30 years' time. But I can already tell you that I don't think Bulgarians expected miracles from Simeon when they voted for him. He wasn't seen as a hero. It's just that at the time of the election, people were bored with traditional parties, and this made things easier for new parties to emerge. So Simeon II seized the opportunity and won the elections. It was the right time for a new face to run the country.
Simeon II failed to raise the living standards of Bulgarians and was defeated by the Bulgarian Socialist Party in 2005. Antoinette Primatarova is a former European Affairs Minister and researcher at the Sofia-based Center for Liberal Strategies. She is not impressed by his balance sheet as Prime Minister. In fact, she says he did not act like one at all.
Personally, I never had sympathies for him. He perceived himself as a former king, and he was behaving the years when he was prime minister as a king. He hates journalists. He hates being asked questions. He never answers to the point of the question. So for a king, that's perfectly okay. but not for a prime minister, not for a politician.
Simeon II is currently mired in a corruption scandal. It's unclear at this stage whether that will compromise his political career. Borislav Velikov says it won't. He is a member of parliament and belongs to the Simeon II National Movement. He acknowledges that the party failed to meet the expectations of the Bulgarian people, but he's convinced that Simeon II is the right man for Bulgaria and for Europe. One of the reasons why, he says, is that Simeon is a king, or was a king.
Simeon II remains the political capital of Bulgaria. Maybe his education was related to this fact that he is and he is still a member of the royal family, and being also relative of Queen Elizabeth II or with Albert and with many of the royal families in Europe. And it is something which also gives to Bulgaria a certain value.
It's still unclear to me whether Bulgarians see Simeon as a monarch or as a political leader. Maybe they're not sure themselves. We'll have the verdict, or at least a clearer picture, in the autumn when the country heads to the ballot box in the presidential elections. Nick Champeau, Sofia, RFI.
Though the last time Poland had a king was way back in 1795, at least five monarchist parties are vying for public attention. There are lots of potential successors to the throne, as throughout much of its history, Poland had elected monarchs rather than dynasties. Krystyna Kolosowska reports.
Leszek Wierzchowski, a regent of Poland and leader of the Polish monarchic movement, singing its hymn. Established in 1991, the party is striving to reinstate constitutional monarchy in Poland. Now that there is no king on the Polish throne, Leszek Wierzchowski, a politician, writer and poet, now in his 50s, declared himself a regent and is performing royal duties from his home in Sosnowiec, southern Poland. The movement's manifesto says that Poland should have a king to whom the cabinet would be subordinated as an advisory body.
The Council of Ministers would work out long and short-term policies. MPs and senators would concentrate on how to implement these policies, constituting a brain trust. Programs of political parties would be of secondary importance. Today, political parties come up with various programs which are not realized. We need a modern monarchy, which I propose as the regent of Poland and the Polish monarchic movement.
Adrian Nikiel, who leads the Organization of Polish Monarchists, believes the reinstatement of monarchy will be impossible as long as Poland is a member of the European Union, but he is optimistic.
Such artificially created structures tend to collapse in a matter of a few decades. I think that the tensions we see in the EU will make it disintegrate sooner or later. Monarchy cannot be an exclusive addition to democracy. We have in mind genuine monarchy, which is authoritarian, anti-democratic, anti-parliamentarian.
The views on monarchy differ among the supporters of its comeback. Self-styled regent Leszek Wierzchowski wants monarchy, which is progressive and modern. Adrian Nikiel popularizes a wholly different idea. Both believe in the importance of the role of the church. The oldest organization here, the Conservative Monarchic Club, established in 1988, doesn't actually believe that a monarchy can be reinstated in Poland. It's rather a grouping of people, including some leading politicians, united by respect for conservative values, says Adam Wielomski, its vice president.
Our club was created to bring together people who are devoted to the same ideas. It should not be associated with demands to reinstate monarchy in Poland. We are monarchists in that sense that we cherish that political philosophy idea, Catholic traditions, but also think about the realities, such as Poland's membership in the EU.
The picture would be incomplete without a word on monarchic likes and dislikes. Leszek Wierzchowski, for example, is often called an imposter and a fraud. Other monarchic organizations blame him for handing out royal and nobility titles, which Wierzchowski has bestowed on such widely differing figures as the charismatic first Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa, the world-class heart surgeon and now health minister Zbigniew Religa, and the communist-era icon Jerzy Urban, editor of the controversial Nie Weekly, notorious for its harsh attacks on the clergy and the conservative government. Adrian Nikiel, who heads the rival organization of Polish monarchists, founded in 1989, doesn't beat about the bush when it comes to branding Leszek Wierzchowski as an ex-Communist Party member.
I wouldn't be surprised if he was a security police agent delegated to destroy and ridicule the monarchic movement in Poland.
Ironically, Leszek Wierzchowski uses the same arguments when he describes his critics. Political analyst Jarosław Petz says that, unlikely as the reinstatement of monarchy is, it might play an important role raising the self-esteem of Poles.
Monarchy can create a value of bringing the nation together, uniting the nation, of re-inspiring the Polish people to believe in the future as a nation in Europe, like the monarchy is in the Netherlands or in Belgium.
In Germany, royals stopped playing a role in politics back in 1918, when the last emperor, Wilhelm II, abdicated. The new law of the land, the Weimar Constitution, then put an end to the monarchy. But it didn't put an end to Germans' interest in all things noble. Since there are no German kings or queens to talk about, Germans simply look beyond their borders to those countries which still have active royal households. Republicanism is nice, most Germans will tell you, but modern-day fairy tales with sparkling princesses dripping with glamour are also good to have around, even if they're seen from a distance. Carl James reports from Berlin.
A queen in her jeweled crown rides among adoring crowds in a gilded carriage. A handsome prince falls in love with a commoner. Later, standing at the altar in a magnificent cathedral, he marries the beautiful young woman, who emerges from the church a princess.
I think we are all growing up with fairy tales where princes and princesses play a major role. So suddenly, when we get older, we discover, oh, they are still existing. It's not just a fairy tale.
Rolf Zelmann Egebert is one of Germany's best-known royal watchers. He's often called upon by public television to comment on royal affairs in Europe. He says German interest in European royalty is high, and from his standpoint, growing. When he began covering royalty in the late 70s, maybe one television channel would report on a marriage or a big funeral. Now, he says, they all do to some extent. That's even though Germany has been living without a monarchy for almost 90 years. Or maybe that's the reason, he says, that interest is so high.
And elsewhere, particularly in republics who have lost their kings and queens in the course of history. If you compare the changing of the guards in Britain with the reception for a head of state in Berlin, you can discover the difference.
The changing of this guard, however, is taking place in Copenhagen. And yes, with their tall, fuzzy hats, rifles, and guard shelters that look like big, colorful pencils standing on end, Queen Margareta's royal guard at her palace has some pizzazz that the police officers guarding the German parliament in their dull green uniforms lack. So the Germans, thirsty for some glamour and an escape from the humdrum of everyday life, drink it up.
Leipzig hat lange auf sie gewartet. Schon im letzten Jahr wollte das schwedische König.
They get their appetite for news of the royals sated in various ways. For the slightly more serious-minded, there are the public television stations, which report on weddings, funerals, or, like in this report, on a visit of Sweden's Queen Sylvia to Germany. Sylvia, a German commoner who was catapulted to nobility by marriage, is lovingly referred to here as simply Our Sylvia by many. For those with more salacious tastes, there are other royal possibilities.
Partyluder Cora Lee über ihre Nacht mit Robbie.
All the major German stations have programs devoted to the more sensationalistic side of things, including royals or royal scandals. Or walk into any shop selling newspapers and magazines, and one row will be devoted to what the Germans call the Rainbow Press, weekly gossip magazines aimed largely at women that feature stories about the royals. The reason they're so popular is simple, says Angelika Haug, editor-in-chief of one of them, called 7 Days.
So I personally think everything starts with little girls wanting to be a princess. And naturally, it's still a privileged life, living in beautiful houses and castles and having servants and going to balls and parties, wearing jewelry.
Most of the women who do read them aren't little girls anymore. They're between 40 and 60 for the most part. And they didn't have too many balls or servants in their lives, but they sure like to read about them. This week's issue wonders about possible new revelations in Princess Di's death, asks if Princess Stephanie of Monaco is pregnant, and casts a shadow of blame on Norway's Crown Princess Mette Marit about her baby's illness. But is any of it true?
I think it's true, but naturally we sort of make it up perhaps a little bit.
Angelika Haug says her magazine gets current photographs of the royals, and then their writers try to discern what could have really been going on when the pictures were snapped. Say a photo of Mary and Frederick of Denmark, who look like they're arguing.
And then we sort of, on a psychological side, we try to explain what it could be to our readers. We could say that perhaps in that case that Mary, she didn't like that Frederick or her husband has been away for 2 weeks for a sailing trip, and maybe that was why they are not in a good term at the moment.
For royal watchers like Rolf Seelmann Egebert, that kind of thing is the worst variety of voyeurism, and pure fiction as well.
If you think only of the deadly diseases, which, you know, have actually gone through all royal houses of Europe, according to those newspapers, you should be surprised if there is any body still alive.
But for many Germans, eager for something out of the ordinary, or to identify with people's lives which they wish they had, truth is secondary. What matters is getting a taste of glamour or tragedy at the highest levels of society. Anna, who says she's in her late 50s, was shopping on a Berlin street.
They are really into this kind of news, like what the Queen of Sweden is doing. It's easy for people and satisfies their curiosity. What is he doing? What is she doing? What is she wearing?
61-year-old Jordin Renate says the royals satisfy a basic human need.
People like reading gossip. It's a fact of life. She's pregnant, she's not, she's cheating. Maybe it's because people's lives are so boring that they're willing to spend a lot of money on these magazines.
And they do. Statistics from 2003 say some 9 million copies are sold a week. Although when many people are asked, they won't admit to reading them, or even caring in the least about what colors Princess Mary of Denmark chose for her new bathroom. Peter Schaumburg owns a flower shop.
When you ask someone, no one says they're interested in them. It's like with porn magazines. They sell like crazy, but no one admits to buying them.
So while interest in Europe's royal houses is strong, even if it's some people's dirty little secret, what doesn't seem very interesting to Germans is what's going on with their own nobility. The monarchy here might have been abolished, but nobles are still around. In fact, it's estimated that there are some 80,000 people with aristocratic titles of some sort. But these days, they usually all have day jobs and live low-key lives. And when it comes to nobles, Germans seem to think if there's not a little pomp and circumstance, and maybe a dash of scandal involved, real or fabricated, why bother? For Deutsche Welle Radio, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
Finally, a monarchy that is alive and well, and which continues to play a large role in people's lives. Sweden's monarchy stretches back some 1,000 years, and since the early 19th century, the Bernadotte dynasty has been on the country's throne. Despite 1,000 years of tradition, though, the Swedish royals have managed to honor the traditions of the past while at the same time being able to modernize itself and stay in touch with the needs and wants of a 21st century society. Sweden is a constitutional monarchy, which means that the monarch's duties are regulated by the country's constitution. Today's royal family includes Sweden's head of state, King Carl XVI Gustav, and his wife, Queen Silvia. The couple have 3 children, heir to the throne, Crown Princess Victoria, Prince Carl Philip, and Princess Madeleine. 2006 has been a big year for the royals here. In April, King Carl XVI Gustav celebrated his 60th birthday, and his wife Sylvia celebrated her 30th anniversary as the country's queen. To honor the occasion, a special exhibition is currently on display at Stockholm's Royal Palace. Our Queen is a look at some of the most glamorous and exquisite gowns worn by the German-Brazilian-born Silvia Renate Sommerlath. Shasten Hogsgord of the Royal Collections.
It all started half a year ago when the Queen came to the director of the Royal Collection and said, "What about showing all my dresses that I've used at the noble banquets?" And we just got so thrilled and so excited because that was a wish for several years to do such an exhibition. But the Queen thought that was much more suitable now when she had been Queen for 30 years. And it's an extraordinary collection of 29 dresses because one year she turned ill.
And of course the dresses are also a journey through time, through Queen Sylvia's time, but also through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to today.
Definitely.
What kind of journey is that?
You could see the difference from the 70s, 80s, and today. If you look at the dresses from the 70s, you will notice that the waist is cut rather low and also with a soft cut. And then you come to the 80s, and suddenly you see those wide shoulders like the dynasty style that you had in the 80s. And then you come to this time, the last few 5 years, and you could see that is a much more sleek silhouette like in the 1930s. So you can definitely see the differences in fashion, but still, they're timeless.
And what kind of reactions have you gotten from visitors to the palace who have seen this?
They're absolutely thrilled. They just love it. And it's also interesting to see that all generations, both men and women, immediately start to discuss, which one do you like? I hate that one. I love that one. And you can see that definitely gets people talking to each other.
And how much longer can we see this exhibition then?
Until the last of August.
So that's quite soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because then we have to use this room for state visits and other occasions in September. And if we're lucky, we might extend the time, but we're not sure yet.
And also, besides all of the wonderful Nobel dresses, there's also one very special dress also on exhibit here.
Well, the one that got it all started, the wedding dress, of course. It's made from Dior in Paris, and a very simple cut in silk. And it was worn on the 19th. Of June in 1976.
It's not just about glamour and style, though. Our Queen also focuses on Her Majesty's work, as I heard from Palace spokesperson Morgan Jalle.
The Queen has a deep engagement in different organizations that work towards trying to make life better for vulnerable children all over the world, and also for scientific research for healthcare.
What are some of the organizations that are being shown at this exhibition?
One, for instance, is the World Childhood Foundation, a foundation that the Queen took the initiative of founding in 1999. And the organization works all over the world to help children in vulnerable situations to make things better for the children, both in Europe and in other countries all over the world.
Despite some calls for an end to the monarchy in Sweden, the royal family is as popular as ever, with an approval rating that hovers between 70% to 80%, depending on which polls you consult. But how can such an age-old institution survive in these modern times? According to Morgan Jalle, it's because the family is, to put it simply, popular.
I think the Swedish monarchy of today is even more popular than ever. And in this modern world, I think people have a need of an institution that is non-political and that also people can rely on in different times of happiness and sadness.
As always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, just log on to networkeurope.org. That's networkeurope.org. There you'll also find information on how you can subscribe to our podcast. That's all we have time for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Juan Navis. Thanks for joining us.